Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the New Statesman podcast that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich. This week it's a seriously festive TV special in which we'll be reviewing the highlights on the small screen over the Christmas period.
We'll be talking about the new BBC adaptations of Little Women and The Miniaturist, The Highway Rat, Season 4 of Black Mirror, Judi Dench, My Passion for Trees, and lots, lots more.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to a very special festive episode of Seriously. I'm hoping that everyone listening to this is lying in some sort of Quality Street-induced coma, not quite sure about what day it is, and just soaking up a lot of festive TV, because that's what we're here to help you with today. Because it does sometimes feel overwhelming in the Christmas break, just how much TV there is.
It does. And I have to say, I have seen some tweets and Instagram posts of people who, like me, buy the festive issue of the Radio Times and get their highlighter or their biro out and ring all the things. I have definitely done this and it really helps. But if you do not have access to the Radio Times because you are not lucky enough to live near somewhere where it's stocked, then yeah, we're going to help you out with what's good and what's maybe not so good over the next few days.
I think one thing that we've kind of talked about this year is there are some things missing from the festive TV lineup. One thing that we've sort of brought up several times on Seriously is that there's no BBC Agatha Christie adaptation this year because of Ed Westwick and the allegations against him. So not a sad loss in terms of not seeing Ed Westwick on our screens, but in many other cases, it is a sad loss.
Yes, that is true. So yeah, for the past few Christmases, the BBC have put on a pretty high budget adaptation, often of a lesser known or in some cases not even previously adapted Agatha Christie short story. This year it was supposed to be Ordeal by Innocence. It has been made, but they took the decision to pull it from the schedule because they didn't want to kind of give prominence to an actor that's facing very serious allegations, which is a decision that we very much support. But it is still a little bit sad that there's no Agatha Christie this Christmas because, and this is something we're going to come on to, the whole period drama at Christmas thing is a very well-established trend, trope.
Exactly. And it's funny because there's actually nothing specifically festive about Agatha Christie, is there?
And there
isn't with a lot of these things. So last week we did a Jane Austen festive special, and there's nothing necessarily specifically festive about Austen. Lots of them have a Christmas scene in them, but that doesn't make them particularly Christmassy. Same goes for all kinds of period stuff that they show every year without fail at Christmas. But there just is something delightful and wintry and festive and kind of family-ish about watching a period drama, especially kind of like an adaptation of a famous old novel. I feel like that The Bleak House, the Dickens Bleak House that was on a few years ago, came on over Christmas. Like all of those great kind of iconic winter period dramas seem to happen over either Christmas or January if you're feeling particularly out there and edgy. But yeah, so there are a few of those on this year, aren't there? Even if we don't have the Agatha Christie, we do have some other things to choose from.
Yeah, so I think the first one we're going to talk about is the BBC have done a new adaptation of Little Women, which is not something that lacks for adaptations in the past. There's the quite famous film from the 90s with Claire Danes and Winona Ryder, which for me anyway is definitely the kind of iconic Little Women. But yeah, so they have put quite a lot of money by the looks of it into this new very, very classically set adaptation.
Totally. And like you say, that 1994 Little Women is so hard to keep out of your mind when you're thinking about Little Women adaptations. It's quite a challenge, really. But yeah, this is new on this year. It's on BBC One and it has Maya Hawke as Jo March, who's the daughter of Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman. I didn't even know Uma Thurman and Ethan Hawke had a kid, but they do.
No, me neither.
And she's a teenager and she's now got the lead role in this Little Women adaptation, and there are some other more familiar names in it as well.
The one I recognised was Catherine Newton, who's in Big Little Lies,
yes,
plays Amy.
Yeah, she's great, isn't she? And we've got Emily Watson, who's in so many British things, playing, you know, Mother March, Marmy, and Michael Gambon, who just like comes in to be like any old man in any BBC period drama now. It's like his stock role. He's Mr. Lawrence, who's the uncle of Laurie Lawrence, if I got that right.
A great uncle. I think, or no, so I think he's grandfather. He's actually a grandfather. And then also Angela Lansbury plays Aunt March, mm-hmm. great aunt of Meg, Jo, Beth and mm-hmm. Amy. I have to say, in common with lots of people, brief sidebar, I'm having to re-examine my feelings of love towards Angela Lansbury after her response to the Weinstein hashtag Me Too scandal, but that's a subject.
I know. I do sometimes kind of feel bad for these much older women who had to adapt to a very different time and had to kind of decide weird things like sexual assault can sometimes be a woman's fault, because that was the kind of the society that they were brought up in, being kind of like wheeled out to make comments about current cultural conversations about sexual assault and so on. But yes, you're absolutely right. It was a stupid and annoying comment to make.
Yeah, I mean, I both wish that people wouldn't ask her stuff like this, but also wish that she would put a tiny bit more effort into educating herself. But anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about Little Women. The book was published in 1868, follows this family of four daughters who live, they live somewhere near Boston, right? In kind of Massachusetts.
America.
but specifically Northern America, because their father is off fighting in the Civil War. So he's like fighting on the side of the North against the South. So they live somewhere in New England. And it's all, you know, very snowy and very lovely. You know, the whole story is just about these four girls / little women, as their father calls them, as they sort of navigate their tricky teenage years living with each other and their neighbours, boys, marriage, career, ambition, all that kind of stuff.
So I watched the first episode of this. We're actually recording sort of slightly pre-Christmas, aren't we, Caroline? So none mm-hmm. of this has been on telly yet for us, but we have managed to get hold of what we can early. So we managed to see the first episode of this Little Women adaptation, and actually quite a lot of the main action of the novel happens quite early up if this adaptation is structured faithfully according to the book, because we kind of begin right in the middle of Christmas, which I can't remember if that happens in the book or whether they've drummed that up for the
No, that is right.
Yeah, so that's nice. So it's sort of watching the family who are, you know, they're not wealthy, right? They are struggling for cash a bit. Nor are they in poverty or anything like that, but they are struggling to kind of have a lavish Christmas. So they have one kind of main meal of their day, but on Christmas Day, it turns out that a local family who have absolutely nothing are really struggling for food. So they donate their Christmas breakfast to them and share it all out. So this kind of, you start with this very kind of nice, heartwarming few scenes, which introduce you to the different personalities of the four girls. They do very well in being, every single line is like, well, Amy, I would say, because you do have to quite quickly get to grips with who all these quite similar looking sisters are. And we get the introduction of Laurie Lawrence, the neighbour who catches the eye of a few of the March sisters. And yeah, quite a lot happens, I think, because for me, the most iconic moments of Little Women are, spoilers ahead, if you haven't read Little Women, obviously, and if you want to be surprised by the adaptation, are the book burning, the hair chopping, the ice ring accident, and then later the death of Beth, Those are the four main things. And we get three out of four in the first episode.
Yeah. This adaptation starts on BBC One on Tuesday the 26th of December. And I think there's going to be three parts in total. But yeah, it does feel very front-loaded in terms of plot. So I am interested to see like how they fill out episode two, essentially. But yes, it is interesting. So I have not watched the 1994 film for quite a long time, nor have I read the book. And the two of those moments that you mentioned are linked, the book burning and the ice rink accident, because Amy burns Jo's novel that she's working on because she's annoyed with her for not taking her to the theatre. Then Amy has an accident while skating and Jo really beats herself up because she didn't, like, you know, keep Amy safe, essentially, because she was so annoyed with her. I think probably in common with a lot of people, when I watched slash read this when I was younger, my sympathies were all with Jo. I was just like, how dare Amy? Also, because I'm an older sister, like, how dare her little sister have so little respect for her creativity and ideas and all this kind of stuff. But actually watching it in this adaptation, and also there was quite a, I can't remember where it was published, but I will find the link and put it in the show notes. There was a piece published in one of these sort of American magazines recently, which was like in defense of Amy March, which made the and I'm very persuaded that by this, but made the excellent case that Amy actually has quite a shit time in Little Women, and it's not necessarily that surprising that she acts out. And basically, aren't we all Amy March in some regard?
That's interesting. I haven't read that piece, and watching the adaptation, I didn't feel much sympathy for Amy March. So maybe the piece is just a very good, very persuasive argument. But I do agree with you that Jo March is one of those interesting figures in literature where she's kind of designed for a bookish young girl to identify with. And we talked maybe a little bit about this. I can't remember what in relation to what, maybe Anne of Green Gables or something. I really can't remember. But we've talked before about how it's kind of like an easy win to like have a novel aimed at women and have this kind of like bookish young girl.
She's Hermione, right? She's, I'm not probably using this term quite correctly, but like she's the Mary Sue for the reader, in that she's your self-insert if you happen to be a bookish young woman yourself reading
it. I guess so. And she's creative and she defends her ideals and she's kind of more strong-minded than most women her age, and you know, all those kinds of like tick 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 for what I felt like me growing up anyway. And I think as you get older, sometimes you can resent those characters a little bit more, because it's a bit like, I don't know if it's a case of it being like, hang on, isn't this a bit of an easy win? Or wait, actually, isn't she a bit self-absorbed and a bit annoying in a way that she that you don't realize when you're a teenager yourself, because you're like, well, duh, so am I, so is everyone.
And we're expected to make allowances for her because she's creative and has ink all over her hands, kind of thing. I think I'm right in saying that the argument that this piece makes is that actually in some ways the March family is a very difficult family to grow up in, because Amy has these older sisters who are, you know, Meg is held up as so pretty and so polite and all this kind of stuff, and then Jo is so creative and out there and all this kind of thing. But the family dynamic is very much about self-examination and are you doing the moral thing and all this kind of stuff. It gets presented, including in this adaptation, as what a warm, loving, wonderful environment to grow up in. But then also how difficult and oppressive that must feel if you're having a bad day.
One thing that part of that this adaptation I think brings out very well, that I don't remember being that prominent in the novel or in the adaptation, but again, I haven't read or watched either for a long time, is Beth's kind of mental health and the fact that Beth is really, really struggling to be a person in the world in the way that her three sisters are, you know, her one younger and two older sisters are doing kind of effortlessly. Like, Beth is set apart from her sisters because the other three, even if they're very different in terms of personality, they're all pretty like vivacious and pretty confident and
outgoing.
Outgoing and keen to socialize and excited by the world. And then Beth is really, really struggling to do what her family see as quite simple tasks. And as you say, they frame it in this very moralistic way. It's not just like, oh, poor Beth, she's not getting the most out of her life because she's too nervous to go to work and she spends a lot of time indoors with a headache. It's more like, well, Beth's not pulling her weight. She's not doing her moral duty to the family or to her local society. She's not it's considered a kind of moral wrong that she's doing by having these struggles, although they are also very sympathetic. It's that must be very difficult for Beth to have her kind of struggles contextualized in that way, because it does feel a bit, I don't know, paternalistic and patronizing.
Yeah, it does, because she's definitely shown in this adaptation to be exhibiting like all the classic signs of anxiety, you know, in that she's worried about meeting new people, she's worried about going outside, she's worried about new social situations. And yeah, her mother does just kind of say, like, you've got to buck up your ideas and get on out
and
there.
And it's more than simple nervousness, and it's a serious mental and by extension physical condition that she's kind of suffering from. So
the actor shows it as a physical manifestation, which is, anyone who's experienced anxiety knows that that's what it's like. You know, a friend of mine quite recently managed to finally get a diagnosis for anxiety, having spent a year being investigated for heart problems because doctors were convinced he had some kind of like heart murmur, and it's like, no, he has anxiety. You know, these things do have physical pathologies.
And like, she's having all these migraines and headaches, and the family can't actually really afford all the painkillers that would require for her to make those go away. So like, there's all these extra levels of kind of difficulty in her being a woman in that time, suffering from this particular type of mental health issue. And I think that's really interesting, and something that I feel like they've kind of teased out of the novel a bit more. That, you know, faithful fans of Little Women might get in touch and say, no, it's there in the text the whole time. But it does feel like they're emphasizing that element in this adaptation, which I like, actually.
I did as well. And it definitely means that, because in other regards, like costumes and setting and so on, it's very lovely and so on, but not distinctly lovely from the 1994 film, if you know what I mean. Ditto most of the performances.
Yeah, exactly.
I think they're perfectly good, but they are also not like innovating necessarily with the way we've already seen these characters, other than with Beth in this regard, which is really interesting. And definitely, I also think this benefits from what we were talking about last week with the Emma special, that because this is a multi-part TV serial, it maybe has more space to, for instance, explore matters of mental health than it would if it were like a 100-minute film.
Totally. And it's really hard to compare with Winona Ryder as Jo March. That's such an iconic performance for me. I think Maya Hawke is very good, but there's nothing that makes her stand out as kind of, I feel like that performance from Winona Ryder was really one of her most iconic performances, and she's just so kind of sulky and sparky, and there's something really annoying and really interesting about her. And Maya Hawke is quite pleasant in this.
She is quite pleasant. Also, something I think is so good about the Winona Ryder interpretation is the physicality, because, and I definitely remember this from the book, Jo is constantly being told off for being like angular and slouchy, and basically not being good at wearing clothes, especially not the sort of like cinched in big skirt styles of the time. And she's like constantly traipsing around holding her skirts up around her knees because she just can't be asked. Whereas I think Maya Hawke wears the clothes a bit too well.
It's always a bit rich in either adaptation, though, hearing the line, Joe, you're only beauty, when they go ahead and it's like these absolute supermodel women, and you're like, sure, Jan, sure.
only beauty, my ass.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Speaking of very, very attractive period adaptations, I wanted to quickly mention the BBC's adaptation of The Miniaturist, which I know you haven't seen
yet.
I haven't. But I've seen the first 90-minute part of it. It's quite long. This is an adaptation of Jessie Burton's best-selling novel, which is set in Amsterdam in 1686 and follows this young girl called Nella who sort of moves from the country to the city to marry this man called Johannes Branton. So she gets set up in his townhouse with his slightly aloof sister, played by Romola Garai, our fave.
Yeah, we do love her, don't we?
And it's meant to be quite a spooky story. I have not read the book, but people have told me that it's kind of like a thriller, really, because the reason it's called The Miniaturist is that as a wedding present, Nella's husband gets her this doll's house, which is a perfect replica of his house where she now lives. Right. And he encourages her to track down craftsmen in the city to get little objects made for her doll's house. And she finds this guy, or this person, we don't even know who they are, listed in a sort of guild thing just as the miniaturist. And she writes to him and says, I would like, you know, a miniature lute, a miniature this. And so these little parcels keep turning up with miniature things. And she quickly realizes that they're kind of predicting things.
Okay.
So she gets sent things that hasn't ordered. So like the little miniature dog appears with blood on his head. And then a couple of days later, there's a terrible accident and the dog like gets stabbed in the head, you know. So she starts to realize that the miniaturist, whoever they are, is somehow controlling them. Or it's quite creepy. But anyway, I can totally imagine myself getting into this plot as a book. But in the adaptation, I was mostly just in it for the amazing costumes and the beautiful
setting. Is it beautiful?
So beautiful. Like so many like beautiful women wearing little mob caps and amazing framing of the scenes, like lovely bodices. Everything is so beautiful. The plot kind of washed over me, I must admit.
Okay, fair enough.
So anyway, I think this would be a perfect watch if you like looking at like beautiful fabric and you're feeling a bit blissed out after a lot of roast potatoes.
Yeah, interestingly, I watched Crooked House, which is kind of another Agatha Christie adaptation, you know, from the Agatha Christie novel Crooked House. And it's a weird one because it's airing on Channel 5, I think, on Boxing Day, and it aired earlier in December as well. But it's a movie, and it was made to have a proper mainstream movie release, and it hasn't had one in the UK yet, and Channel 5 are getting it first, which seems really weird to me.
So bizarre, that, yeah.
And then I watched it, and I think maybe it's because it's just not that good, but it is an all-star cast. I know. It is an all-star cast. It's got Glenn Close. It's got Amanda Abington from Sherlock. It's got Christina Hendricks. It's just like a really nice level of fame to the cast. It is sort of beautiful. So one of the key parts of Crooked House is that it's this big sprawling estate that all these members of an extended family live in. So you have the patriarch, who is the kind of murdered party, and then you've got his three sons and their wives, and then his very young wife, and you know, a great aunt, and they've all got like a little bit of the house to themselves, and it's all decorated like in tune with their character. So they've so they've had a lot of fun with that, and like every single character has like a totally different but very, very overdone part of the house that looks like them. So Christina Hendricks' house is like all pink and sexy and like kitteny. And then Amanda Abington's this kind of weird botanist, and it's all very mid-century sort of. Do I mean mid-century? I mean, it looks very mid-century, but that would probably be anachronistic. But it does look like that.
It could well be, yeah.
And yeah, it's just, it's interesting. But it kind of, it's a bit weird because I think sometimes these movie versions of Agatha Christie struggle a bit with the pacing and how to get the twists and turns right and stuff. And for me, this definitely struggled with that. Like, every scene was just like really weirdly paced, and there were so many characters, you never really got to know any of them. It was just like a big sprawling game of Cluedo, which I think sometimes isn't very fun, because it's just like, wait, hang on, I have no understanding of any of the motives of any of these people, because they're all just being gestured to as potential subjects rather than being like investigated in any interesting way. So it kind of fell apart for me. But seeing as there is no Agatha Christie on BBC One, if you can set a little record on Boxing Day for Channel 5, you will get your fill, but it is very long and it is very weird. So, I mean, I think that's sort of it for in terms of period stuff on the BBC this year. I mean, there'll be the Call the Midwife Christmas special as usual, but other than that...
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so make sure you're tuning in, listeners, because that's your lot.
In other festive fare, there are two brilliant but weird things on the BBC this year. On Wednesday the 20th of December, so it will have been on last week by the time listeners are hearing this, BBC One are airing Judi Dench : My Passion for Trees, which when I read about this in on the BBC Media Centre, as I do as a culture journalist, I actually could not believe it was real, because it's just such a funny kind of concept for a show. And we always on Seriously joke about how the BBC seemed to have this like formula for like very British national figure does very, very twee countryside thing.
Yeah.
Like Penelope Keith's Hidden Villages. And I don't know, it does, isn't there like Mary Berry's canal boats?
Mary Berry Goes to Stately Homes is her current thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like someone does canal boats. There's Michael Portillo's Railways. There's all sorts of them. They've also got one called like Champagne Tasting with Ab Fab, something like that.
Yes, that's on this Christmas, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Joanna Lumley and
Jennifer Saunders. It's a whole genre. I'm just like waiting for them to get weirder and weirder, but this is a great one. So yeah, Judi Dench : My Passion for Trees, and I have to read to you from the description, because it is that good. Oscar-winning Dame Judi Dench is one of Britain's best loved actresses, but few people know that Judy holds another great passion, a deep love for trees. And yeah, that is literally the concept. Judi Dench has a 6-acre garden with loads of fucking trees in it, and she wants to learn more about trees. And this is an hour-long program where Judi Dench like touches some bark and is like, ooh, I love this tree.
And there's a great bit as well where like a man with a lot of sort of gizmos helps her listen to the tree.
Yeah, she has an ear trumpet pressed to the trunk of a large, I don't even know what it is, it's not an oak, but something, some tree.
But yeah, this is a gorgeous program. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so did I like wanted to blog about this for work, because I was like, this will be funny and there will be loads of innuendos in it where Judi Dench is like, ooh, girth, and oh listeners, there is plenty of that. I love her like talking about inches girth and like her love for trees, but it is also like weirdly moving. I wasn't expecting to be moved, but I was.
It really is, and it's very kind of, it's not sad at all, but it is sort of like, you know, woman nearer to the end of her life than the start, find solace in the outdoors.
Totally. And it is kind of sad, but in a way that I was like, oh lol, I'm going to laugh at this old woman and her obsession with trees. And I came away from it like, oh god, this woman is wise and has learned to accept death in a way that I never will and never can. Because basically, the programme starts with her like wandering around her garden, and she's like, ah, this is Stephen Leslie, and points to a literal tree. And you're like, okay, you've got full human names for your trees, like first names and surnames. And then she's like, oh, this is Ian Richardson. This is Natasha Richardson, no relation. And you're like, hang on, Natasha Richardson. And suddenly you're like, wait. These are trees named after people. And she's like, yeah, I name every time someone really important to me dies, I plant a tree for them and then like care for that tree over many years. And you're like, oh my God, that's a really beautiful thing to do. Mm. That's amazing. And she's got this whole network of people in her life just like out there in her garden for her to like go and like think about and talk to every day, including her late husband. She's got a tree that was planted before he died, but a tree that's now kind of in honor of her husband, who's been dead for 16 years, called Michael Williams, the actor. And you're just, I don't know, I was just found it really amazing. And it changes the whole kind of tone of the program, really, because when she's very keen to find out, for example, if different species of tree communicate with each other,
yeah,
it kind of has an added layer of emotion to it, because you're like, oh yeah, it would actually mean something to her if all the trees in her garden were kind of communicating in some sort of way, and she knew that they had a system of life that was going on beyond their human lives and beyond her own human life. I don't know, it's really kind of amazing to think about.
Yeah, it is fascinating, and I kind of take my hat off to whoever at the BBC commissioned this, because it is bonkers, and it is not
it's totally not
like Michael Portillo's Railway Journeys.
No,
you know, it is, as you say, it has broader points to make about mortality and stuff, which, you know, like Man in Red Trousers Takes Train to Prague does not have.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, I definitely recommend this as like a kind of little quiet moment in your Christmas viewing.
Yeah, also if you want to see Judi Dench become moved by a 16th century knit comb.
Yes.
This program has it all. She like literally, they find her a knit comb made out of some really, really old wood, complete with like dead knits still in there. And she's like gasping with absolute adoration. And you're like, this is gross. But she loves it. She just can't get enough. She cannot get enough of trees. It's amazing.
So not at all like Judi Dench, My Passion for Trees, but similarly cheering and warming of the heart is the BBC's adaptation of Highway Rat, which is another Julia Donaldson book. This has also become a bit of a Christmas tradition, hasn't it, that they do a Julia Donaldson every year.
Totally. They did The Gruffalo, then they did The Gruffalo's Stickman. Child, then they did Stickman. I think, did they do Room on a Broom last year? I don't even know. I can't remember. But then this year they've gone for The Highway Rat, which is kind of a weird one in the Julia Donaldson canon, because it's a parody of The Highwayman, which is a famous poem that I feel like almost everyone in Britain did at school at some point, like primary school.
The moon was
school.
A ghostly galleon tossed on cloudy seas.
Oh like, my God.
I could literally recite it.
Nerd alert, nerd alert. yeah, so it's kind of weird one, because you're like, why I just can't imagine Julia Donaldson sat there like, I really want to remake The Highwayman, but hear me out, guys. He's a rat. but yeah, it's...
I kind of love her for that, actually.
Yeah. But for me, one thing that really stood out to me about this adaptation, which has... I think David Tennant is the is the titular Highway Rat. And Rob Brydon, love of my life, Rob Brydon is the narrator. And also, spoiler alert, later revealed to be the horse. The horse at the end is like, and that was the tale of the Highway Rat, and you're like, wait, it was the horse all along. It's just really weird. But yeah, one thing that really struck me about this is how much the rat is shamed for enjoying his food, which is not a message I want to receive on Christmas Day. No way, no how, thank you, sir. Because although he steals food, which is like arguably morally bad, there is a lot of lines
in this.
He
does like eating.
Yeah, there's a lot of lines in this about like how he's fat and gross, and you're like, no, allow the rat his food. So yeah, I don't know. I enjoyed The Highway Rat, but I also didn't want to feel guilty about eating my quality street at 4 p.m. on Christmas Day. Like 4:45 on Christmas Day this airs. That's like prime eating and like belly patting time.
Yes, absolutely.
I really don't need to see like a rat kind of like belching and then all these like starving other animals being like, ooh, the Highway Rat, he's so fat and selfish and greedy. Just wasn't a message I was up for. And then at the end, he like loses loads of weight and becomes this like weird, humble, meek, disgusting little guy. I liked the kind of like anti-hero who was like running around stealing people's carrots, because at least he was bold and charismatic and had a proud, you know, gouty form. But this kind of like little skinny, meek guy at the end, not a fan. Absolutely not a fan.
No, definitely not. And as you say, not a good message for Christmas Day or any time, really. But... I've seen like the first half of it, and I did find it very charming.
It is very charming, and I do love Rob Brydon, and I always think the animation in these is really, really brilliant.
Really good, yeah.
All joking aside, it is kind of like set apart from other kids' stuff on Christmas Day, because there's just something really like prestige about it. I don't know if they spend a lot of money on them, but it looks like they do. And they always get like really, really good British voice actors to do it, which is always really fun. And I'm really glad that they've made one this year without James Corden, because he's absolutely bloody everywhere in every animated thing of all time. Lest we forget his crimes in the Emoji movie earlier this year.
And also, just brief look ahead for next year, I just watched the Ocean's 8 trailer and was really, really, really enjoying it up until the point where James Corden appeared.
Oh, is he in it? Oh, yes. For God's sake. He's Peter Rabbit coming to cinemas soon, and it looks really
unacceptable.
Awful. So, I mean, I have a soft spot for James Corden, always will, because of Gavin and Stacey and his friendship with Harry Styles, but come on, mate. Just overexposure. It's
back
a thing.
Back off,
it's a thing. So we're going to round out the podcast by positing a little look ahead to things that we're going to be talking about in the new year. One thing we're definitely going to be talking about is McMafia, which comes out on New Year's Day, starring our very own Grant Chester. I was going to say...
The hot vicar.
I know, I was going to say Grant Chester's very own then, but that ruins our joke, which is that he's not from Grant Chester, but he is called Grant Chester, which is our favourite joke. Yeah, so that's meant to be the equivalent of the Tom Hiddleston, Hugh Laurie starring The Night Manager that was on last year. And it's just like basically... hot James Norton is hot spy, seemingly.
Yeah,
or like hot confused spy. Hot didn't know that he was connected to spy's spy.
And it also has, I think I read in the press release for this as well, that it's like a kind of international co-production. It has like it's got a heavy like Russia subplot, but also is being aired in like other European countries have sort of contributed to it and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a bit, I think it's got a like nod to the kind of European crime movement with things like Spiral from France and that kind of
thing. Right, exactly. Some other things I'm looking forward to discussing next year. Second season of Search Party, which is already all on 4OD. So I hope that over the Christmas break, seriously, listeners really binge through that because it's amazing. I absolutely loved it. There are quite a few things returning actually in that vein in January, like The Good Place comes back for the rest of its second season, and I'm looking forward to the second season of This Country as well, and there's all kinds of things popping up. But one thing we thought we'd talk about in a little bit more detail is Black Mirror, which reappears on Netflix on the 29th of December. So it's really just there for the tail end of your Christmas break in early January, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And it's dropping at pretty much the same time as it did last year. And we were commenting that there's an interesting kind of cultural effect with Black Mirror. I think because it doesn't have like a central series narrative, it is a anthology show. Each episode explores a completely different set of characters and scenario and technology that I don't think people binge it in the way that they do with stuff where they want to know what happens.
Yeah.
So often it's like the second or third week of January before the conversation around Black Mirror really blows up, because it takes that long for everyone to have seen whatever episode it is that's going to really prompt all the think pieces.
Exactly. And it's not like a series with cliffhanger endings where you really have to just motor on through it. But also I feel like there's no set order that you have to watch these in. And I saw Charlie Brooker kind of tweeting, Charlie Brooker, who's obviously the main creator of Black Mirror, tweeting about how they had spent ages trying to decide what order to release them in, but that it didn't really matter and you could watch whichever, watch them whenever the fuck you want kind of thing. So I think sometimes it takes a little while for the key hitter to emerge, because I feel like last year, everyone talked up loads about Nosedive, which was the first one, which was this pink pastel...
the Instagram one.
Instagram-y one. But actually, after a few weeks, San Junipero, the kind of more positive, kind of the rare positive one, I think almost the only positive one in the three seasons of Black Mirror. I know that's debatable. Some people might see it as quite a tragic story, but I think for a lot of people it was quite hopeful. That gay love story really emerged as the most popular and most kind of zeitgeisty and most conversation sparking episode of Black Mirror, but it took a little while for it to become obviously that one. And it's interesting to me that the new series of Black Mirror, which has six episodes, as you say, all separate, but that the overwhelming kind of response that I've heard to it so far And this is, again, we're talking before the release date, so who knows what will happen when it actually comes out. But from critics in their preview discussions, is that this is a more generally optimistic series and less kind of... I feel like Black Mirror was getting towards self-parody, where lots of people were like, oh, Black Mirror, what if phones, but too much, you know?
Yes.
People were saying that all the time, and how it was kind of a bit Banksy, maybe.
Yeah, I definitely think from the trailer, and so you've watched this, I haven't managed to watch it yet, but from the trailers and from the stuff I've read, I definitely think they've reined it in a bit, and they've done that quite rightly by refocusing it on very specific aspects of technology, because I think that was always when Black Mirror was the best, when rather than, as you say, being like, what if phones but too much, they were like, but what if this specific granular thing,
yeah,
but for everywhere.
And sometimes, like, I feel like the Twitter episode that was all about like people getting abuse on Twitter,
yes,
and it's then such getting, an unrelatable like, murdered, phenomenon. And it's when people talk about technology in that way, it's always so problematic for me, because it's actually like three people who are like verified and have 50,000 followers on Twitter who are talking about something very niche, whereas I hope this series of Black Mirror kind of pulls away from that. So I've only watched one of them so far, but that was Hang the DJ, which I specifically picked because I thought it looked a little less intense than some of the others.
Yeah. So this is, am I right in thinking this is based around dating?
Yes.
So this is the intersection of technology and dating.
Yes. So as with many Black Mirror episodes, there's not actually that much kind of, you're not given that much context up front. Like there's no one comes in to sort of say, and here we are in the year, blah, 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 where this dystopian world sees, you know, it's just, you're just kind of introduced to these characters and you kind of have to make sense of it as you go on your own. And these two people are in something only referred to as the system. It stars Georgina Campbell and Joe Cole as the lead couple. And they're introduced first on their first date. So Joe Cole, you might recognize from Peaky Blinders. And Georgina Campbell, you might recognize from Broadchurch season 3, I think, the one where her dad is Lenny Henry. They meet as kind of new people in, quote, the system. It's their first ever date in the system. It kind of looks a bit like a first date setup where then they're in this very nice restaurant. But they have this kind of circular device. It's almost a bit like a smartphone that tells them where to go, tells them who their date is. They sit down and then they start chatting. And one thing they can find out straight away, or they can choose not to find out about, is the expiration date on their relationship. So they've been assigned an amount of time to spend together. It could be a matter of hours. It could be a matter of years. And all of that is supposedly a way of learning about the participants so that the system can eventually assign them their absolute perfect match, where they'll live, you know, in perfect soulmate happiness forevermore. These two characters meet and they've got 12 hours. And so you watch them have this very, very lovely but very, very short fling, but they really have amazing chemistry. And while I was watching it, I just felt like I hadn't seen people with such great and relatable chemistry on TV in such a long time. And there's something very British about the way they flirt and everything, so there's a lot of kind of like, oh, fuck off, like it's very teasing and very kind of dry, and they're just quite like mean to each other the whole time, but in a way that's very flirty and very sexual, and they just work as a couple. And I really, really bought it. Like, totally bought it, way more. And it made me think, like, actually we watch so many like American TV dramas where they're like Stranger Things, for example, no one has any chemistry in Stranger Things at all, and we just accept it. Like, that's just like TV couples are just like that. Even something like Game of Thrones, no one really has any proper chemistry.
No.
And in this, it was just really nice to see a relationship that you could actually genuinely buy as happening. I could give a lot of spoilers about this. I don't know how much detail to go into, but there's a kind of twist ending right at the end that is very, very lazy if you read it on paper. So I just want to talk about that a little bit. So don't watch any longer if you don't want to be spoiled. But the setup is that the two lead characters are not assigned each other as soulmates, even though they clearly want to be with each other, and they've been given all these other horrible partners and they hate it, and they're like, shall we just escape? And there are all these things that suggest that this world is like not as it seems, and there are all these men everywhere with tasers that you think are going to kill them if they try and escape. But nevertheless, they try and escape. And it's revealed that the world that they live in is a total simulation. And they escape and they're the 998th version of themselves to go through that process and escape the simulation. And then it kind of like zooms out and it means that they're a 99.8% match. And this is actually simulations of people inside a dating app is what you're looking at. And so then you're in a pub and the Smiths panic is playing and the characters in different dress in a different time look at each other in a bar as they approach each other for the first time. And it says 99.8% match on both of their smartphones. So it's kind of a weird, like, and it was a simulation all along, kind of annoying twist.
And also a bit The Good Place as well.
It is a bit The Good Place. And I don't know, a bit Alice in Wonderland, It Was All a Dream, a bit anything. But so they were actually just in a dating app all along and they're not real people. But then it's weirdly, I don't know if I was just a bit tired and emotional. I was really moved because the implication is not like, oh, and now they're just going to have a disposable relationship and never see each other again. It was like, actually, these people are really, really right for each other. And now they're going to meet each other for the first time. And it's really, really exciting. And look what the opportunities of this dating app have given them. So even though it was really a very kind of lazy trick in the writing, I did kind of like it because I found it so optimistic. And so like, maybe dating apps will be able to point us towards someone who is the perfect partner. But at the same time, it kind of told that story in a way that made it seem like matching with someone on Tinder is actually a way to fuck the system, because they keep saying like fuck the system in the show and these two people are trying to escape the system and they don't want to be matched with someone who's just like on paper perfect for them. So it's this weird like simultaneous rejection and propaganda for the idea of being matched with someone on paper. And I don't know, there was something I quite liked about it, because I think if you're in a relationship that you think is really good, I'm sure there are lots of things that you can sit down and point out about it that maybe don't seem great on paper, but you do it anyway because you're in love and you think it's great. And I think that was the feeling that I got when I watched this, of like, oh yeah, we might not be perfect for each other on paper, but we're gonna fuck it, we're gonna do it anyway. And I really liked that. I thought it was really like, I don't know, romantic and cool. And I'm such a cynic that I never think anything is romantic and cool, but this I did. And I don't really know why. And maybe people are going to trash it when it actually comes out and I'm going to be in the minority, but I really liked it.
Well, that does sound interesting that he's kind of putting those two forces up against each other. Saying like, yeah, the idea that an algorithm can predict true love, but also can it, you know?
Yeah, it's weird because they're kind of contradictory ideas existing happily at the same time in this program. So that's weird, but I did really like it. So you'll have to watch it and tell me what you think.
I will have to watch it and see, yeah. But it does sound already like Black Mirror and Charlie Brooker's like unique ability to like create things that fuck with people's heads is still bang on trend.
And shout out to Jessie Cave, who's in Hang the DJ for about five seconds, but just brilliantly, as she always is with her weird cameos that we see her doing stuff. She's always so good. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including on Apple Podcasts, where you could leave us a rating and a review if you fancy. It makes us happy and it also helps other people find the show.
If you'd like to come and see us in person, check out the events page of our website, seriouslypod.com/events. Details of our next pop culture quiz and anything else we're doing will appear there.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We're SeriouslyPod on all of them. Follow us to keep up with what we're up to or to chat to other listeners about things you've enjoyed on the show.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show or hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.